Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 703, February 2024.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell. This is an episode about a film released in 2023. It's up as we record this for many Oscars. It is Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan. And I wanted to talk about this movie. We did the Barbie episode. To fulfill our contracts as podcasters, we must now do the Oppenheimer episode to create the perfect Barbenheimer balance to the year gone by in film. Also, I'm just going to put it out there. This was my favorite movie of last year. Anyway, we're going to talk about Oppenheimer with these people. No pressure. Kathy Campbell is here. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jason. Is anyone ever going to tell the truth?
It's a good question. Probably not. all of her scenes will be in black and white. It's Shelley Brisbane. Hello.
Hello. That guy was totally not Harry Truman.
It's Commissioner Gordon is who it is. It's Gary Oldman, Harry Truman. It's close.
Right. They almost rhyme. Almost. And listen, they only had one day to film him, so right. You can only do what you
get
can.
Get him in there. And Cicero Holmes is here. Hi, Cicero.
Jason. When Christopher Nolan makes the movie about me, Cillian Murphy will play me.
Oh, perfect likeness.
Yes.
That's good. Well, he's good in everything.
Yeah.
So you just take Cillian Murphy when you can get him. He was, you know, the Scarecrow in the Dark Knight movies, directed by Christopher Nolan. Right. I was saying to my wife, this is my favorite Christopher Nolan movie. Now, I am not a Christopher Nolan fanboy. I know there are super Christopher Nolan fans out there. I'm kind of mixed on Christopher Nolan. Like, there are a lot of it where it's like, I like some of his movies that people love, and I'm kind of meh on some of the movies people like, and so I end up feeling like I'm just not all in on Christopher Nolan like some people are. However, I love this movie and think it's his best movie. So and I said to Lauren, I think it's his best movie, and she said, well, what have I seen of his? And I was like, well, there's the two Batman movies. She's like, yeah, she didn't love those. Said there's Insomnia, and there's Memento. And then I realized, wow, I've seen a lot of, and I said, there's that boat movie. And she's like, what boat movie? And I said, Dunkirk. That's that is a boat movie. Yes, it is. It is a boat movie. Anyway, he's made a lot of movies, and I think a lot of good movies, but I'm not one of these people who's like, well, give me Oppenheimer, give me Christopher Nolan. It doesn't matter what it is. It's about like Tenet or, you know, whatever. I don't care. You know, Inception. Well, no, I, this one just hit me. So it is, I did read, not the book it's based on, but the Making of the Atomic Bomb a couple of years ago, because I thought it was a very interesting subject. This is based on another book that I read after I saw it in theaters. That is the definitive biography called American Prometheus. Nolan does some interesting things with this movie. So Cillian movie. It is. That's what it is.
It is the Cillian movie.
It is very much a Cillian movie.
Featuring Cillian Murphy. He's in almost everything that's in this movie. But it's two time frames that you know, that Christopher Nolan with his multiple interwoven timeline thing that he does. But this one, I appreciated he does it right up front. He labels them fission and fusion. One of them's in black and white. One of them's in color. Now, I will complain that one of them's in color, but it itself also is mostly comprised of flashbacks to his whole life.
Yeah.
So it's not quite one time frame. It's sort of like all the time frames, except for the other set that are in black and white. Also, interestingly, the stuff that is the most present day, you know, it's the 50s, is the one that's in black and white. and the rest of his life story is in color, also kind of interesting. But at least I feel like for a director who is often, he's going to trick you with his crazy time sequencing, in this movie, he just lays it out. He's like, nope, there's this story and that story, and I'm gonna put them together, and that's how I'm going to make it work. It's interesting. What do people think about the way it's structured?
I liked it. I sometimes find if you tell me that a movie is going to jump around in time, I am not predisposed to like it because often that means the director is trying to be too cute about it. This was
kind of exhausting sometimes.
Yeah, it's exhausting. Exactly. And whether it wasn't just the fact that you went from black and white to color and back and forth, it was I found it easy to follow and I found it made sense. And I found that it gave the movie a kind of a style that I appreciated because a biopic. Oh, my God. And I've watched so many old style biopics. And I knew this was not going to be one of those.
Yeah.
But it's so hard to do a biopic and make it interesting because and then he did this and then he did that.
Right.
So how do you structure it? And it seems like a biopic is kind of the perfect opportunity to fool around with time a little bit, but not lie to the audience or try to trick the audience, which I think sometimes a director will do. Hey, look what this fun thing I can do with time. It's up to you to figure out where you're going. But I don't feel like Nolan did that at all. I think it was very easy to follow, very easy. And it made sense and it broke up the sort of ladder of let's move from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, I really enjoyed. So I was a big nerd and I watched the extras, of course, because I'm like, ooh, I love people that are passionate about what they do and what they create. And this is a perfect example of like someone that really, really enjoys what they do and is very careful about everything that they choose. And I mean, just the fact that they went to Kodak to be like, hey, can you make this film, but in black and white? Like, who does that? Who imagines like, oh, I want this.
Nolan.
Like, let's just, yeah.
Because he has a budget and he can
exactly.
do that.
Yeah. Exactly. And something that I think was also really interesting is how, so it wasn't just the black and white versus color, but the position of the cameras also with black and white versus color. So the black and white was kind of meant to be sort of from Strauss's point of view,
right,
but not really. And mostly color was from Oppenheimer. And I think like that interlinking of it, like very deliberate, obviously, because it's Christopher Nolan. That's the only way he works. It just added that extra layer that made it easier to follow than a lot of these. Ooh, what time is it? Who knows? And then the fact that no one really aged too. Almost helped it. So like there wasn't, oh, you know, this is a you know, the guy's older because he's got a big gray mustache now.
Right.
Like there, it was all just very like, okay, we're going to tell you the story and let it happen.
The time sequence thing, I agree. Like, look, Christopher Nolan made his name with the most audacious, time trickery in his first movie in Memento, right?
Right. That's why I was afraid when I realized there were going to be time shifts.
But here it is, I think, crystal clear the whole time. And I listened to an interview with him about writing the screenplay. He was on John August's Script Notes podcast. And John August asked him about the time frame thing. And he said, for Oppenheimer, he said he thinks it's cheating if what you do is sort of what Shelley described, which is you tell a linear story and then you chop it up in order to be tricky or something. And he said, I wrote it in order of what it's in the movie, because the point of the two time sequences is juxtaposition of, you know, the one scene followed immediately by the other scene. That means something. It's actually meant to echo at every point. And watching it a second time, I picked up on so many more conscious echoes that happen throughout. It's not just at the end where Strauss gets what he's been given to Oppenheimer throughout the movie. It is just throughout. There are all of these moments where it's commenting on one scene by leading into the other or vice versa. And yet I never felt lost, because in part because Oppenheimer essentially is his own narrator, the way that color section is structured, where he's giving his prepared statement to the review board, he's telling the linear story of his life. I admittedly in flashback, but it is linear and he's his own narrator. So he can provide, the movie can show him describing what's happening when it needs to place it in a particular context. And as a result, I didn't ever feel lost, which is a thing that, you know, you can do that with a movie, and Nolan does that with movies. Like Dunkirk, I'm completely lost at many points, but not in Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer felt really clear to me.
This is the least, I mean, directly to that point, Jason, this is the least confused I've been about a timeline in a Nolan film ever. Dunkirk, I was lost the entire time.
Yeah.
Dunkirk, I saw in the theaters with my partner and a couple of some friends of ours, and we sent the women in first and came in late and came in like 5 minutes into the film. So we went and asked them what's happening, and they had no answers
for us.
They
had no idea. Yeah.
So
there's boats, Cicero. There's right. Just lots of people
so,
on boats.
Yeah. So water. The entirety of the film, I just spent confused.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, yeah, there's goofy timeline stuff that you have to, you know, you have to take a quiz for beforehand in order to know it going in, and there's a cheat sheet. But yeah, this film, I completely understood it. I thought it was, very well done. It was brilliantly done by Nolan in this particular instance. Again, to your point, Jason, I'm probably more of a Christopher Nolan fan than you are. I think the bizarre part about it is the things that people love, I'm probably less enamored with.
Interesting.
And there are some films that people don't really like that I'm like, oh man, these are great. I loved Inception. I also really was very fond of the chances that he took with Tenet. And that's the thing that I love about Nolan, you know, like him or not, or like his films and not like his films. He's audacious enough to take risks. And and in a business such as Hollywood, in the movie business, it is so rare and unique to see someone actually take the risk. So to see him continually take those risks is remarkable, and I will always applaud and reward by going to the cinema to go and see it, someone who is willing to go out and do those things. And you may not be successful all the time. In fact, I don't want you to be successful all the time.
Right.
You learn more if you're not.
Right. And, but he was 100% successful with Oppenheimer. The other thing Nolan is successful with is generally the theater I go to cost me $7. In matinee, which is before 6 p.m., and it's $9 after 6 p.m. to go see a film.
I didn't realize you could watch movies from 2023 back in 1997. Right, that's amazing.
Right. So the fact that I didn't go to that theater and instead went to an IMAX theater where I spent $20-something for a ticket and spent it on two tickets for me and my partner to go is really, really saying something. And I left completely satisfied. It was incredible to go see this film in IMAX and really get to experience what it was. Just an incredible, like, If you're hearing me and you've already seen the film and you didn't have a chance to see it in IMAX, and you think about those scenes that would have been spectacular in IMAX, that you can imagine, yes, they were. Huh. Yes, they
well, that's,
were.
That's interesting to me because in the whole Barbenheimer time, when friends were going to see one or the other or both, everybody who wanted to see Oppenheimer wanted to see it in IMAX and did and said the same thing you just did, Cicero. I watched this movie today. Sorry, I'm late prep. I watched it today and thought to myself, there are parts of this movie that I'm sure are spectacular in IMAX, and there are other parts of this movie where it, because it's so talky and there's so many facial close-ups and so many dudes in suits in rooms, I was thinking to myself, does that feel like a waste when you're looking at that IMAX screen, or is it all worth it when you get to the point of either the atomic bomb or the sort of stylized changes between black and white and color? I mean, it's interesting. In a three-hour movie with so many different things happening, well, with kind of two different things happening, as either sort of an epic, yeah, spectacular kind of scene or guys in suits.
Yeah.
You know, what's that like in an IMAX environment?
Hats, too. Lots of hats.
Yeah, lots of hats.
I saw it in 70 millimeter, and I thought it was spectacular too. Not IMAX, just a regular 70 millimeter. But that, again, just the opportunity to see a movie in a packed theater that it was hard to find seats weeks after it came out. It was beautiful. It was also beautiful in 4K HDR on my TV yesterday. Yeah. Right, like it is a beautifully shot movie, and I feel like one of the things that Nolan is pushing in this movie is his filmmaking skills, right? Like, instead of it being, let me show off how clever I am as a screenwriter, I feel like he wants to make this movie more, you know, it's not just the writing, it's the visuals. And, you know, he's not his own cinematographer. He has a cinematographer, but I think that his goal is to make this movie look and sound with the sound effects and the music, yeah, and be structured in a way that it kind of fulfills that hole. But certainly the black and white looks gorgeous in 70 millimeter. I imagine looks gorgeous in IMAX, and and you usually get in a theater like it, you also get pretty good sound, which I think is a huge part of this movie too.
Right. And if there is one thing that I have a problem with respect to Nolan films, it's Hans Zimmer's soundtrack, right? Like the score is too, like, I feel like a 70-year-old. Is too darn loud.
Yeah.
Can you turn it down? Interstellar was again, I went to see it in IMAX because it's a Nolan film, and it was too much. It was way too intense. It was just loud for the sake of being loud. There were things blaring all over the place. And this film, there were great swells, and there was great music, and it was a great score, and I didn't think they overdid it. And one of the things that was fantastic was the moments when there was no score, when there was no
the silence.
The silence in there was so eerie, like it almost became a horror film. It was really, yeah, really great.
Especially around the Trinity explosion. This Ludwig Göransson did the music for this. And there are moments where I think he's trying to give a little Hans Zimmer. There are moments when I feel like he's trying to be almost a little Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross, almost a little bit.
Yeah, I can see that.
But it's really good. I like how it is. You're right, Cicero. So the music at points, because look, we haven't even talked about sort of what this story is about, but like, it is kind of a horror story, depending on your point of view. And it is tense and serious, and the music will often directly make you feel that about what you're seeing. And then other times you're left with a silence.
But it was understated, even in the parts where the music is underscoring what's happening on screen. I never thought it was trying too hard. It wasn't one of these sort of, hi, we're doing blockbusters. It wasn't John Williams, you know. We're not doing blockbusters here, or Hans Zimmer. Frankly,
no, like restrained.
I didn't pick that connection up, and now I want to go back and watch just so I can see if I can find the Hans Zimmer, because that is kind of freaking
there's
me
moments
out right
where
now.
He's trying to be bombastic, but it is very restrained. I just there are moments where I'm like, oh, okay. I watched it and thought, is this Hans Zimmer? Because this sounds way too calm to be Hans Zimmer. And then it's like, oh, no, it's Ludwig Göransson. Okay. All right. But I think he is trying to give, in moments, he's trying to give Christopher Nolan kind of what he figures he wants, which is Zimmer-esque. But it's, it's way more restrained than that. Shelley, I am very fascinated by the fact that you watched this movie today. That's really
interesting. I am fascinated by that, too, because it seems like the kind of movie that I would have watched on opening weekend. And I'm not sure why I didn't. I love history, and I was interested, and I've consumed both written and filmed Oppenheimer material before. But for some reason, I maybe it was the Nolan factor, because I'm not I'm not a fan, but I'm not a fan either. Like, I don't, I was yeah. wondering whether it would be challenging and whether it would annoy me as far as, because I really, I sort of secretly like biopics, even though as I feel like they're very hard to make. I enjoy the idea that you tell the story of something that happened through the eyes of an individual, or that you're just telling one person's story. And so I like them, but I'm often tortured because they're not good. And so I was not worried that this wouldn't be good. I was just worried that it would be too Christopher Nolan-esque and that I would be like, okay, I'm lost. What are we doing? And I just never saw it. And so honestly, I signed up to join you nice people because I wanted to force myself to watch it. And I'm glad it did.
Thank you, Shelley.
But and as I say, from a history point of view, it's very interesting. The thing that surprised me about it was how much material there was. Not just that it's 3 hours long, but how much they got in about.
It's dense.
Yes, it's very dense. And honestly, yes. I think, especially in the last third, I think that might be kind of a downfall of mm-hmm. it, because you have to remember what the relationships are of all these people. And there's the political intrigue that starts to become more clear as to how it's being done in the last third. And I feel like there's just a lot of density that I'm astonished that it was as successful and wildly popular as it was, because it seems like the kind of movie that a certain segment of the audience would love, 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 and the rest would go, what is that? I don't know what that's about, because it's not as much about the effects of the nuclear explosion or even a political story. It's about a bunch of guys in hats, one of whom is a theoretical physicist.
It's the men in suits and hats, I think there are at least two women in the movie, and maybe at most
eight named characters.
Yes, right. Yeah, but there were really only two women who are important at all,
who quote unquote matter.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Since you mentioned it, Shelley, structurally. So first off, the book. So having watched the movie and then read the biography and then watched the movie
today.
Again. All today. No.
That was me.
Look, the book is very aware that it is the definitive book about this man, that there will not ever be a book that will be able to be the definitive book, right? So, and the book knows that. And then famously, the one author got bogged down and the other author came in and went through his notes and got the project going and they got the book done. But the problem with that is there are controversies about Oppenheimer where they did lots of research to put on the record all these things about his security clearance being revoked. And to do that, you've got to talk about all of his associations with various communists in Berkeley. What? There are communists in Berkeley?
What?
Shocker. and so what the book ends up I liked the book, but I didn't love the book, in part because the book realizes it has to do all the detail work on all the relationships that Oppenheimer had, including with communists and like people who were fellow travelers of communists but weren't actually communists, and deal with, was Oppenheimer a communist and was his brother a communist and how long was his brother a communist, and then all the detail about Strauss, the Robert Downey Jr. character, and about his clearance committee and the transcript of that and all of these things that are going on. And it crushes the story because it's not, at least for me, it's not that interesting. I get that it's really important to history, but I don't care about it, right? Like, I would rather summarize it, and the book can't summarize it because it has to be definitive. Nolan drops most of that right out, but you are left with Nolan deciding to use the hearing and then the confirmation hearing of Admiral Strauss as the juxtaposition for the movie, so that we kind of have a villain and we have a mystery. Oh, what did Einstein say? And we get that kind of Oppenheimer gets the shaft and the guy who shafted him then gets what's coming to him. But while that is an interesting bit of structure, and I think it drags the movie along just fine, to Shelley's point, I also agree. I feel like the last half hour of this movie is aftermath. That after they explode the bomb and grapple with the outcome and worry about the future, after all that happens, I don't know if I care about Robert Downey Jr. getting a cabinet position in the Eisenhower administration, you know? And I get why it's there, but I'm like, it's like, isn't the movie over?
Yeah, I actually had to, you know, pause it to look and see, oh, this isn't just the end. Oh, okay, we've still got, all right, because it felt like the end and like, did I hit the post-credit scene somehow and miss it or what? And no, it was still the actual movie.
Frodo still needs to go off with Gandalf.
That's across, right.
Right. The trouble is that probably the political intrigue part at the end would be more interesting if it wasn't after 2.5 hours of other stuff, including, oh yeah, we exploded a nuclear bomb.
Right.
The other problem is that all that stuff about whether people were communists in the 30s, I mean, that touches so much of political history, of film history, believe it or not. I mean, so many industries and so many groups of people were touched by the were they or weren't they? And there's the whole thing about how communism was tolerated in certain circles before the war, during the war, and after the war. And I was a little disappointed that there wasn't a little bit of explanation of that, because we were allies with Soviets in World War II and previous to World War II. You know, being a communist might have not have been the best thing for your career, but it wasn't, you know, the McCarthy Army McCarthy hearings, which was after the war. And so I found it a little bit bloodless, because it's like, here are all these people that are either communists or fellow travelers. Why are they doing it? What do they believe in? Oppenheimer has left-wing political views. What does that mean? Like, for him, how does that animate the way we see him as a character? We don't learn that because it's not all that important. There's too much other stuff going on in the movie, but it means that it's less interesting because it's bloodless. You're like, oh, he may or may not have been a communist, but what does that actually mean? And then, like I say, there's the whole issue of how communism was treated. This is especially true in Hollywood history, but how communism was treated during the war versus after the war, because immediately after the war, the switch flipped. And that's when you had the really, really harsh crackdowns beginning against people whose political views were fine and dandy, even in the government, 6 months before. And then all of a sudden, after the war, it was not at all cool to have even been close to the left wing. And then you have Senate and House hearings where people are, you know, literally, you know, almost literally spitting venom at others. And there wasn't any of that. There was a lot of guys in suits who were mostly calm. Like, all of these political things that happened in the 50s, nobody is particularly excited. It's all kind of bloodless political intrigue. And so I found that weighed the movie down, because there had to be so much of it, even though, as you say, a lot of it probably was cut out.
Well, the way I kind of saw it, and you know, I think, Shelley, the things that you're saying right now about it only kind of confirm the way that I view the film, is that last portion, right? The part where, you know, we're sitting down, you know, we're sitting at a confirmation hearing, it was the conceit that for which the film exists, right? Is the fact that Oppenheimer is sitting down narrating the course of his life.
Right.
And in the throes of making this narration, you want to give a fair and unbiased account of your life, but you don't want to accentuate things that you know are still touchy subjects, like what really were your left-leaning ideologies? What were the fellow travelers thinking about, and you know, what their purposes were, or, you know, what was going on with the Communist Party? Like, even if we weren't in the throes of McCarthyism during the course of this closed door hearing, or at least his interview, we were close enough to it that we weren't far enough removed from it that people could be objective in hearing the facts of what the minutia of people's beliefs and their ideologies were. So I think that there was some intentionality behind really kind of muddying all of the things that you said about the film, Shelley. I think were at least could be explained away narratively as being intentional.
There's a great scene to that effect where Matt Damon as General Groves is called before the committee to authorize, or, you know, that it's a setup to not authorize Oppenheimer's security clearance. And they ask him, you know, basically, would you, based on the rules that we have now, would you ever have allowed him to be cleared? And Matt Damon as Groves says, well, no, but I've never doubted and his loyalty. But the point is there, which is the rules have changed.
Right.
100%.
And therefore, this is a foregone conclusion. And I don't know, the Strauss stuff, like, it's a nice narrative thing, but I think that the movie wants the audience to care more about the comeuppance of Strauss. Like, the part that gets me the most, and I really do love this movie, but if there is a weakness to me, there are a couple things we're going to talk about, but like, one of them is that the movie, I think, thinks that we're invested more in the comeuppance of Strauss than we actually are. And the best place for it is throughout the movie. It's like, why, there's Academy Award winning actor Rami Malek playing a random guy who appears for no reason as a minor character. We went to Chicago to visit Enrico Fermi, and hey, Rami Malek is there. Surely he'll be important. And then you don't see him again forever. And then he shows up one more time and you're like, why is Rami Malek in this movie? And it's right at the end where it's like, now we're going to have this guy testify. And I feel like the movie actually wants us to be like, oh man, here comes Rami Malek. But when he does, it's like, yeah, he lowers the boom on Strauss, but I don't know. I'm like, okay, like, great. Right. Take that black and white guy. Right. And it's just not like, I get it. It provides structure. It also is about, you know, the turnabout is fair play of what he did to Oppenheimer now happens to him. And then, but like, there's another version of this movie that's shorter that just shows that he does get awarded that award by Oppenheimer, and we get the flashback that I think is really brilliant to Einstein, where he says, when they start giving you awards, those awards are for them and not you. Just, that happened to me, it's going to happen to you. And that's absolutely it. Also, we would have missed the wonderful moment where his wife gets to stare down the guy who basically, the scientist who was Teller? And he like, oh, you shook his hand. And then he wants to shake her hand in that moment in the White House. And she's like, nope. Those are great moments. But like, yeah, I don't know. The Robert Downey Jr. stuff, again, it needs to be there. But I feel like it's like in the book, like, I know this is part of Oppenheimer's life, but I honestly don't think it's the most interesting part. But
I think you might care more if he's a character that people had heard of. I mean, if he was somehow involved. Yeah, if you knew who he was.
Yeah.
And like, I never heard of this guy.
No.
I know who Edward Teller is, and I was fascinated by that because Edward Teller goes on to be one of the architects of Ronald Reagan's Star Wars policy. So he has a long career in this kind of stuff. And so that's I was wondering if they were going to sort of tip to that, and they didn't. But I kept thinking of that about Edward Teller, that like he goes on and he continues to advise people about how to, you know, drop bombs or defend against them.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara especially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. you can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So what this movie, look, why do a movie about J. Robert Oppenheimer? Like, why? The answer is he is a very interesting character who is at a pivotal moment in history. He creates the first modern school of quantum physics in America. There's a great moment. And this is a good use of that framing sequence of him being asked by the commission, by the security commission about this. Like, why did you go overseas? Why didn't you do it here? He said, well, there was nothing here. He said, I thought we had a great program here. And he says, yeah, I made it. Right. So he is this brilliant person who goes overseas. He's miserable in England. He injects an apple with cyanide. That totally happened because he's just kind of despondent and needs and has to go into therapy. They finally send him off to a different program in Germany where he really does sort of learn the new physics that is emerging and ends up going back to the US to start a program at Berkeley. And then that leads ultimately to his involvement in this larger issue, which is the building of an atomic bomb. I also really enjoy the juxtaposition between him and Ernest Lawrence, who is Josh Hartnett, who is this is absolutely true, the big, broad-shouldered, blonde-haired, golden, all-American boy who is the legend of the lab, whereas Oppenheimer is the small Jewish man who is completely theoretical. They are opposites, and they work together, but they are also political opposites. Lawrence is a Republican, obviously, as we've said. Oppenheimer is a lefty. There's a lot of really interesting stuff. That beautiful shots that they shot on the Berkeley campus. I remember when they did that, they were like, on Sunday morning at 8 a.m., the old cars are for a Christopher Nolan movie. Don't ask any questions. And so they shot their shots there. So anyway, it is he's an interesting figure at a very important moment in history, surrounded by a lot of other famous people, including Fermi and Szilard and Teller and Niels Bohr, in a surprising appearance by Kenneth Branagh doing his best Danish accent.
I enjoyed that. I liked that. I liked his Niels Bohr a lot.
Yeah.
And I liked the way they introduced us to him, and then they brought him back later in a way that's like, oh, wow. Because I knew that history a little bit, but I didn't remember at what point he gets to come back to the United States.
Yeah,
the United States.
They smuggle him out, and he just tells it as a story. It is a great story. He's like, literally, they smuggle him out in an English plane, and he didn't get his mask on right, so he passed out, but he didn't die. He woke back up. So they got
he's
him out.
He's still alive.
And so we get all of that. Like, he's at a moment in history, and he becomes, he's a fascinating character too, because he is not the superstar theoretical physicist. He is a star, but they put him in charge. Groves puts him in charge of building this secret lab and building the bomb. And he is the one who picks New Mexico because he spent summers riding horses all around in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico and thinks, oh, I got a good place. We'll kick the boys' school out and we'll build a thing in Los Alamos. And that part of it is, to me, the most interesting, because he's a man of many contradictions. He is look, everybody's complicated, right? But he is a very complicated person with a very complicated professional and personal life, and is put in the middle of the war machine trying to stop the Germans. All of that, you know, I find that all fascinating. And I do think that the fact that he's telling the story by these questioners leads you to, you know, they're interrogating it, but they're also allowing him to explain the significance of the things that happened in his life. I think it's all really, you know, there are a lot of interesting things. Do you wear a uniform or not? That's like a whole chapter in the book, but it's one scene in the movie about, like, take off the stupid uniform. And how do you herd the cats that are these scientists who are not soldiers, and they're and the army people are just frustrated by them? Like, there's just a lot of good stuff in there, while you're also thinking to yourself what they're making, right? And they are inaugurating, and the last scene drives it home, they are inaugurating the creation of weapons that, once they exist, everybody's going to want to have them, and at that point there's the capability of destroying the planet. Like, that's it. Like, whether they ignite the atmosphere or not,
right?
That is it. And it's just, what a fascinating set of That's why Oppenheimer, right? He allows you to tell all of those stories wrapped around this one guy.
Well, and he's just this mercurial dude.
Such an interesting guy, right?
Yeah, like, and who has obviously both qualms about what he's doing and great passion for the science part and for the part that says if we do this, we can cut the war short. That is not a minor part of why so many people of what you might call, you know, lefty persuasion end mm-hmm. up on that side of the equation. And he has this complicated personal life. He ends up, you know, repudiating things that he believed earlier in his life.
Moment that Lawrence is like, you got to drop this if you want to be on this project, he's like, done.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The other thing that was interesting to me is that whenever I've read, and I haven't read American Prometheus, but whenever I've read anything about Los Alamos and Oppenheimer, General Groves is also a huge character, mm-hmm. more so than even in the movie, and also quite a character, not just a general, but he's pretty outrageous. I think he had some personal quirks. He and Oppenheimer didn't always get along, and mm-hmm. I kind of expected it would be a war or a mano kind of thing between those two guys. And it's really not. Groves is there, and he's clearly the military leader of this outfit. But they say in the movie, they give Oppenheimer a great deal of the managerial credit for making this thing happen. You know, you're build him a town. Go build, because Oppenheimer says, I want a town. Go build a town.
Yeah. It's a fascinating dynamic. Oppenheimer. Well, like the whole scientist, I'm reminded of that line, like, I just built the bomb, I don't drop it. This is what is at the core of this movie in some ways, is you have scientists who are well aware of what they're doing. And we see this to this day in the tech industry, right? Which is, there is the glory and excitement of making new things and going into new ground. And you can choose to not think about what you're doing and how it impacts the world and society, because the glory is in the discovery and in furthering whatever your area of study or your area of interest is. And you see it in these scientists too. They are more aware than I think your average Facebook engineer maybe is, in terms of thinking of the social impact of this, because a lot of them, and this is true, and it's mentioned in the movie, a lot of these nuclear physicists, by the way, are Jewish, and many of them have family who is in or has fled Germany in the 30s. So everybody is really well aware that they need to do this before the Nazis do. And the good news, and it's mentioned in one scene, and it's really absolutely true, is the best thing that happened to the nuclear program of the U.S. is Hitler's anti-Semitism, which drove all the good scientists out of Germany. And the ones who remained were not really given enough material to do what they needed to do. So they were able to manage that. But these scientists are very motivated to stop Hitler, which is what when Hitler dies and it's just Japan, that is the beginning of that discussion of, well, wait a second.
This is not my deep enemy. Do I still want to kill these people? Look, there's not one person in Japan.
Can we put the genie back in the bottle? And the answer is no.
Nope.
You can't.
Because the warmongers still want to do what they want to do with it.
And they know the Soviet Union is going to be the enemy in the long run after this is all over. And it is that idea of, it's all wrapped up in Oppenheimer, right? He is aware, at the time, he's sort of aware of it, but he has the dawning realization, which is, now Hitler's out of the equation, but we're still building the bomb. It's a great achievement, but at the same time, it's a horrible achievement. And then when the bomb is dropped on Hiroshima, it is an achievement and there's applause. But even in that moment, and there's that scene where the echo, it's like a horror movie. Right, Cicero, that stomping on the bleachers that we've heard as a horror sound throughout, and we discover it is his moment of triumph where the bomb has been dropped and they've been successful. And by that point, it's already a horror for Oppenheimer. It's just fascinating, right? Like, it's that juxtaposition of, I've done this great thing, I've done this terrible thing. They're the same thing.
Yeah, and there are... Great art, obviously, has the ability to draw parallels to the real world. And there were a lot of parallels in this film that if you're paying attention, even somewhat, right? Like if you're the 14-year-old boy or girl looking through your phone while you're watching this movie, you'll be able to see the parallels that you can draw from the way the world is today to the cautionary tale that history tries to teach us through this film. And, I applaud the effort that was made here. And I, again, applaud Nolan for just the risks that he's willing to take, and the fact that he's been so successful throughout his career that the studios will green light and just give him whatever money
he wants.
Right, whatever money he needs in order to make those things come to pass. The other thing that he's able to do, because he is so great, is assemble pun not necessarily intended, an Avengers like, squad of actors, right? Like there are just incredible performers and performances up and down the list, right? Like, Rami Malek, right? Like you said,
yeah.
Jason,
Rami Malek comes in for
two scenes and he's fantastic in those two scenes. But why is he in this? You know, like Casey Affleck's in here and Robert Downey Jr. is in here. It's just, everybody's here.
Why is Matthew Modine in this movie? Well, he's in it, right. And David Krumholtz actually is great as Robbie. Robbie's a great character. That's
right. There were so many times I just had call sheet open on my phone the entire time.
Me too.
I'm like, who's? Oh, yep. I know them.
It's that
I know,
guy.
Right. I know that person. Right. Yeah.
It's that. Well, because he's got that ability. I want to talk about the women, but before we do that, I want to talk about the bomb dropping just a little bit longer, because there's a visceral, the scenes at Trinity are amazing and they're very visceral, and I enjoy the panes of glass and the guy with the sunscreen on his face.
Yeah.
And
oh, that was so funny.
Like there's all of that and the idea that they're like only late in the game does Groves say, like, what do you mean there's a chance they'll ignite the atmosphere? And he's like, no. It's just, we're just kidding. It's probably not going to happen. What do you mean?
Maybe we should move back.
What's better than zero?
Right.
What's,
yeah.
Better,
yeah.
What's better than, essentially zero? He said, well, zero would be better than essentially zero. But the one of the criticisms I've seen about the movie, and I think that it's, I get it, but I also disagree with it, is that the movie doesn't show anything of Japan. And what I would say is I love how the movie handles it, because we stay with Oppenheimer and the horror is clear. There are like hallucinations of horribleness in flashes, and there are flashes of light, and there's just these horrible sounds. And so the movie is very clear. They're not depicting, which I don't think works in the structure of the movie, to depict things that don't happen where Oppenheimer is, but he is haunted by the horror of it. And I think the movie is very successful. I'm interested in what you think at getting that across. Like a different movie, like the making of the atomic bomb, the last chapter of it is a detailed description of what happened before, during, and after the bomb in Hiroshima. The Oppenheimer biography doesn't do that. It's a biography of Oppenheimer. I feel like that Nolan was like, I need to make sure that the horror of the bomb is seen through the horrible imagery of the imagination of Oppenheimer and his guilt. And I think it did a pretty good job of that. And I'm not sure there's any better way that this movie could do it. But what did you all think about how the dropping of the bomb on Japan is handled?
Yeah, I witnessed that through his performance, right? And just you could see the angst and the anguish, and the sheer terror. Like he almost became green. He almost became sick.
All the applause he receives, he's basically disgusted by, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I felt all of that, right? And it was, I guess I want to say that it was not necessarily the first time that I really thought about it from that perspective, because obviously, even as I was learning about the dropping of the bombs, we were far enough removed, you know, in school, we were far enough removed from those moments that the Zionistic enthusiasm for those events had died down. So there was a level of reverence for them. But I think this moment was probably the first time that I thought about, oh yeah, you know what? The guy who made this thing was a scientist, right? The guy responsible for this was a scientist, and he probably, you know, wasn't all that excited about the fact that it was being used in this way. I really was able to resonate with Oppenheimer like you said, Jason, like, oh, I made this thing, and it's great, and I made this thing, it's terrible. I thought it played really well.
I didn't miss the fact that we didn't see Japan. I think some of the desire for that is just perspective. You want to say, well, you know, this terrible thing did not happen to him. It happened to those people in Japan. That's not my objection, because I think seeing it through Oppenheimer's eyes, and also keeping in mind you're in 1945, you're in a pre-24-hour satellite news channel world where what is going to be seen of Hiroshima when it is seen is going to be, first of all, quite a distance in time from when it actually happened. Yeah. And second of all, it's going to be sanitized on some level. Oppenheimer, with a security clearance, will probably see more of the, you know, film that the U.S. military takes, and probably far more than anybody in the audience of a movie newsreel would at the time. But still, the distance from the people who created the bomb to where it landed would have been greater in 1945 than it is now. And I think that's appropriately reflected in the movie. Now, I do think it's interesting that since we're so narrowly focused on Oppenheimer in general, as well as this part of the movie, I'm thinking about all those people that are cheering him, and I'm thinking about all the people who worked at Los Alamos. Did none of them, was there no space to show them having regret? Probably not. I don't know. I think that's where I would have wanted energy to go to the other, because they took, it's very much like this giant thing. I mean, they built a freaking town. They had, you know, hundreds of people. I don't know how many, 10 babies a month worth of people, right. doing these jobs. So it was not a small operation. And yet we are concentrated on a very small number of characters, relatively speaking. And so it's kind of hard to get the perspective of how big the project that eventually made those bombs or it was. And presumably how many different opinions people had, and the point at which people might have had either regret or consternation or horror. But we've structured the movie as a biopic of Oppenheimer, so right. We're kind of stuck with that's whose perspective we're going to show. Would probably also be weird to just pan around Los Alamos and have people drinking their coffee going, wow, this kind of sucks.
And there were, we do see him dealing with people who are resisting the process up front.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so before this happens, the sense that there is some dissent about what happens next and should we still work on this since Hitler is dead is there. And then there's that there's some scenes that are post like the immediate bomb drop where I think the scope becomes clearer. But I think you're right. I was struck by the fact that in that moment, like you put your you move to the middle of nowhere into terrible conditions and have been there for several years now doing this thing, and you did it to be told, in some ways, by the guy who ran the whole thing, like, well, we did it. Good luck. You know, you did all a great job. I hope history doesn't consider us monsters. Goodbye. Right. Like it is. I think there's some human nature in that cheering. Right. Which is like, yeah, but we did it. We did it. Whatever the result is. You know, we accomplished something. And that's the, I think, kind of the tragedy of it, right? Of them and Oppenheimer is like their greatest accomplishment is also horrible. It is. Yeah, it's fascinating. But yeah, it's you're right. You don't, other than those little tiny views into other people, it's all people who are passing by Oppenheimer as he lives whatever his life is. Kathy, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with you all about how they handled Japan and the actual like horrible things that the bombs did. I wish that they had put more energy into what the land that they built the whole town on that was already, you know, owned by people and they lived there and they the military basically came in and said, hey, you're gone. Here, let me give you 50 cents and get rid of your livestock and bye-bye so we can build this town. And like, I wish that there had been a little bit more homage, a little more respect to, hey, oh, by the way, yeah, you can come back now to this land that may or may not kill you in the next 50 years. Right. Who knows what's going to happen? And that's one of the main parts that I was really, I wish that they had put even just a little bit of time on to let
that's
people
a whole
know
movie.
What happened. Yeah.
Well, like the Trinity side, especially, but even the people at Los Alamos, there is that one line where it's like, well, what should we do with it? And he's like, give it back to the Indians. And they're like, no.
Thanks.
We built those buildings. We're going to turn it into a giant national nuclear lab, which it is to this day.
Yes.
Oppenheimer, interesting guy. His relationships with people in general and women in particular are discussed in this. I would say I appreciate the performances by Florence Pugh and Emily Blunt. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, okay.
Tell us how you really feel, Jason.
Well, Oppenheimer, like there's stuff that is not even in the movie or is barely touched on, like that thing about at the very end of the movie, we get that line where they're like, oh, you know, this guy might testify about you because he says you broke up this marriage in L.A. And his response is, oh, well, that's ridiculous. The husband never knew.
Right. Like, what? Yeah.
And you know, it's true that they also gave their baby to friends and said, you raise the baby, we're out of here. That totally happened. So lots of very peculiar things in it, but his relationship with Jean Tatlock, and she I like that he keeps bringing her flowers, but historically and in the movie, she is dealing with mental illness. She does end up killing herself. The movie does leave open the possibility that somebody might have killed her, although there's no evidence to show that. I think showing that this is not a sanitized view of this man is good. I will say the single most ridiculous thing in this movie is that he meets Jean Tatlock. Cut to, she's naked on top of him while he's mostly clothed, demanding that he read from the Bhagavad Gita the actual specific line that he is famous for quoting after the nuclear bomb. And I thought, what? How did you feel
you
about
mean
the
women? That's never, that never happened?
I'd love the women on the podcast to explain to me how they feel about the women in this movie, the very few of them that there are.
Yeah, I forgot about them. Who were they? What happened?
And there were lots of women at Los Alamos. That's the thing, is they weren't not among the scientists, but like at Los Alamos. But we don't see a lot of them. We do get his wife and his mistress, and that's about
well, it. I mean, that is, of course, the only identity that women can have is a wife or a mistress. So it's great that there was that representation in this
book,
movie.
Mistresses represent.
In the book, there are some very interesting women at Los Alamos and nearby who like ran a ranch that they would go to with the scientists. And she knew, and that woman knew more about like the comings and goings and almost everybody, but didn't say anything about it, you know, throughout the whole thing. Yeah. And then at the very end, they revealed like who these pseudonyms really were, which were all these famous scientists. Like there are lots of interesting anecdotes about that and about the wives who were pressed into service to do, you know, to do all sorts of things and making a life there. And
there's so many other stories they could have chosen to have a hint of.
Yeah. And I think Nolan was just like very tunnel vision about it, kept it to very little. But among the things he kept was getting Florence Pugh topless, demanding reading from the Bhagavad Gita.
Right. I'm so glad that time was taken instead of any
Super
other
important.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't think you get, especially with Emily Blunt's character, with his wife, you don't get a sense of the dynamics of the relationship. I mean, they do, each of them does odd things in terms of their relationship. And she's obviously not the mother he would wish for his kids, although he's not exactly the father one would wish for his kids. But I you can't get a read on either their relationship or her. I mean, she, there's a couple points at which she's basically like telling him to, you know, be, you know, stare down the villain, right? And you know, that sort of thing. But it's, you, it's not even, I'm so used to and so irritated by historical pieces where it is 98% white guys in suits and hats. And it's not even just a political thing for me. It's just boring. I just find it, oh my God, here's another, oh look, it's a famous actor in a suit and a hat. Great. But they're all
thank you for integrating my hat observation into your commentary. It is, they're also, it's suits and hats.
No, I will say that ever since I saw L.A. Confidential and read that they purposely did not include hats in a 1950s film noir that was made in 1998, I've noticed historical hat
gotta have those
culture
hats.
Very much.
Well, Oppenheimer is like all about the hat. It's like his costume is his hat.
His hat and the pipe.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
those are the things.
But it's, you know, it's whether you object to it politically as I do, or just as like, could we get more women in the show? It's just boring to see all those same white guys and the women. Like, yeah, I mean, what would it be like living with a weird dude like Oppenheimer? I don't know, because his wife was kind of a weird dude in her own right.
Yes. Yeah, so it's true. That does lead to a fascinating marital dynamic moment where they're like, what you want. Her to testify, you want Kitty to testify, and they're all like, they've got their opinions about Oppenheimer and various women that he slept with and all this, and like how could it possibly be? But it shows in those scenes like she is a fierce protector of him, and I did not come away from this movie understanding their relationship. I'm not sure that anybody not in that relationship can understand it, but I did leave thinking it's more complicated than I can understand from the outside. I did appreciate that about it. And there does seem to be
I feel that way about Oppenheimer in general, even with a three-hour movie, because so much of it is about this sort of the framing device of him narrating his life and then the various hearings and Admiral Strauss's hearing and all of that. Because it's so much structured by those events, you're not really getting as much of a sense of who the guy is in that last third of the movie. By then, if you're going to learn anything about who he is as a person, you better have picked it up in the first two thirds of the movie. And even then, I'm left look, especially with all those close-ups. I mean, there's so many close-ups on faces, but especially Cillian Murphy's. I'm left looking at him and going, I still don't understand you, dude. And that may be the point. That he's a very mercurial dude with a lot of different, and he's not, and that's the other thing, that the trope that people fall in when they make biopics is you try to tell a story of a person. This guy is like this. This guy does this. And everything he does in his life is an example of how he is and how he does this. That ain't how people are. And I think you very definitely get that with Oppenheimer, that he is inconsistent. He is thoughtless. He is, he's a brilliant scientist, which probably causes a lot of interesting affects in his personality. But you can never say Oppenheimer is A and finish that sentence with one or two words.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's right. There is speaking of women in this movie, one of the very early scenes where there's the montage where like he's going to set up the new physics at Berkeley and there's the one guy and he's like, oh, sorry, I'm in the wrong place. He's like, no, are you my student? He says his name. Yeah. He's like, please sit down. Yeah. And then he goes to the board and you turn around and now there's more people there. There is in that initial small group of students, a woman. And I had that moment of like, who is she? Movie's like, you'll never see her again.
Yeah,
like,
she doesn't matter.
Like, see, we put a woman in. We put it,
look
she's
at our
got
token
a
woman.
But
right? She doesn't have a name.
Is but on one level, I say to myself, well, wait a second. Who is the woman who is taking theoretical physics at Berkeley in the 30s? Because that's an interesting story. Was there a woman there at that time, or did they put her in so that they could add a, you know, seventh credited woman in the movie? I don't know, but I. So it's that's the conundrum there, right? Is like, if you're going to put her there, like, I kind of want to know who she is, but it's like, no, the movie's not interested in that at all. It is, it's hard, right? Like, I'm not sure anybody ever knows anybody, but Oppenheimer is like such a mess of contradictions, and I do think that Nolan is sort of like, yep. Like,
well, and to be honest, when you, since there are so few women, every time I see one that is not his wife or his mistress, oh, is he going to sleep with that woman? Is that
right.
The idea?
Ooh, because there's a that new point, love interest.
Mostly
right,
not.
Because there's that point, right, mostly not, or not on the screen anyway. Mm. But there is a point where they call him a womanizer, which may in fact have been true. I don't know my Oppenheimer history that well, but he has a wife and a mistress. Did he have a whole lot of others? I don't know. The movie makes it a possibility, but doesn't dig in. And
it just mentions that one situation where the breakup of that marriage, and like this husband never knew. Based on the book, I would say he probably was not a womanizer in what we would consider high volume. But I think once you are, his wife was married when they met, right? And
hadn't she been married twice before?
She was divorced, and then the second guy died in the Spanish Civil War, and then she married this older kind of guy to take care of her, and then she meets Oppenheimer, and Oppenheimer gets her pregnant, and they agree to divorce at that point so she can marry Oppenheimer and have the baby. So she's got an interesting background too, but like, yeah, so even his marriage is from a position of infidelity. And then, yeah, it's all what I like about it though, is that it's not a sanitized hero story, that this whole movie is about ambivalence and ambiguousness in the sense like his whole life is like that, right? Like, he is a man who accomplished great things and regretted the things he accomplished to a certain degree, but was still proud of them in another level, right? Like, it's all right. Like, I find it fascinating, but to me, I agree. I think that the book shows that there are some women at Los Alamos that I wish we had seen a little bit more of, because they were present, and it wasn't just men in hats in the life that Oppenheimer led, not at all. And we miss some of that. And I also do think that one scene with Florence Pugh is not just ridiculous, but also sort of like gratuitous. Like,
yes,
this is not the kind of movie I expected to have. Like, I expect a movie from the 80s where they need to hold like a car wash in order to save.
Yep.
Like, that's the movie with the gratuitous boob
the
shot
center.
In it, right?
Yeah.
Not Oppenheimer 2023.
It's gratuitous in the sense that after I heard people talking about seeing in an IMAX, the other thing that people said was, wow, that sex scene, you know, that was somewhat intentional. I mean, come on.
Well, yeah.
You're trying to sell a movie here.
Absolutely.
Which I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying that is a piece of commentary that people made about Oppenheimer. Oh, there's a sex scene, which is weird enough to hear if you're about to watch a movie about a nuclear scientist from World War II.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, there's a crazy sex scene? All right, I'll be watching for that.
I wouldn't say, I mean... crazy is not a word
you're
that I
correct.
Would say.
That is not an accurate word.
It is a bizarre.
I think perhaps
it's
that
Sanskrit.
People
read
spoke
it to
of
me.
It,
well,
right.
I become I death destroyer the, of worlds. Does that turn you on?
People who mentioned it were probably looking for a way to say, I don't really get that. I don't, you know, whether they said crazy or whether they said, wow, that is some sex scene and left it at that. It was unusual enough to make the, you know, the Cliff Notes version
the bullet,
of Oppenheimer.
The bullet point.
Right.
Of...
Yes, the bullet point.
What else should we talk about Oppenheimer that we haven't covered already?
I do wish that I had seen it on IMAX. I have only seen one movie on IMAX, and that was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I know, with Johnny Depp, and I'm still traumatized by the pores. So I was like, I can't see this. And I wish that I had. So
you need to cleanse yourself, Kathy. Go ahead and see it.
Right, right.
I do.
Exactly.
I do. So it needs to do another run, please, close by me so I can go see it.
It'll probably happen.
Yeah.
Right. I guess this isn't about the movie, but the aftermath of the movie. Do you feel like it's deserving of the nominations that it's received?
Well, I said it was my favorite movie of the year, so I do. But what is everybody? I mean, and as somebody who went in being like, well, I'm really anticipating this, but it is Christopher Nolan. It's a hit and miss thing. I came out thinking, yeah, this is the stuff for me. But I don't know what other people think.
The way my brain works, I would have to say, did somebody else get robbed in order for the Oppenheimer to get the particular nomination that it got? Because I don't love it as much as Jason does. I have
Who
themes
does?
About set the gold standard right there. But I mean, it's really long. It's bloodless in some senses. I think some of the performances are really good. Some of them are meh. But I don't begrudge it its Oscars unless an Oscar nominations, unless I actually sat down and looked at the people in the category and went, so-and-so got robbed. And I don't have one of those at the tip of my tongue. And we don't have to talk about the whole Barbenheimer of it all.
I mean, yes, I'll bring it up. I think that one of the snubs was Greta Gerwig for Best Director. In this sense of things and the storytelling and the masterful way that she created a movie as well. And I also wonder, in an alternate universe, if Barbenheimer did not happen, I'm on this podcast because I did enjoy it. Like, I thought it was a beautiful film. I thought the people so passionate about it, that sort of stuff, etc. I wonder how popular and in the zeitgeist of, you know, pop culture conversations would have existed before the movie came out, even. Like, yes, the Christopher Nolan fanboys would be all over it. But I wonder how much of that popularity would have still been around if it hadn't have been in the whole weekend.
I think it still would have been nominated for a lot of awards. Oh, I feel like that's separate.
Yes.
It might not have been teetering on $1 billion box office. I think definitely some people saw it, kind of went along with the thing. Although it did dominate IMAX. I mean, this is famously the movie that made Tom Cruise really mad because they booked all the IMAXs for this. And then Mission Impossible came out.
Well, then bonus.
And they couldn't for like, they had 2 weeks of Mission Impossible and then they had to, or a week, and they had to drop it because they had planned this out. So I think it would have been big, but it did get swept up in that cultural phenomenon. And I would say there probably is a different director you could bump for Greta Gerwig in this category. There are some very interesting director nominees this year, but you know, so
yes. Yeah, that. Yeah, my phrasing was a little off. I don't think necessarily that Christopher Nolan should not be nominated.
That's why
for
I didn't
Best
go
Director.
There because I couldn't think of who else was on the list. And yeah, I think Gerwig should have gotten nominated as well. But I couldn't say, well, Nolan shouldn't have and so-and-so should have, you know?
Right. Yeah, I don't know that it deserved best film editing. There were better edited films. I don't know.
How can you even
honestly,
tell? Right, sometimes I'm worried that the people who vote for best film editing, and they are Academy members, but still I worry that they're like, were there a lot of quick cuts? Or, oh, there's two timelines. That must have been hard to edit. And it's like, no, that's just editing a movie.
Is there a haberdashery category in the Oscars?
Oh, man, well, it's costume design, so, clearly.
Right. I mean, the editing clearly had to be done manually because it was all, you know, analog. So
that's why
you get the editing nod, because they had to touch things.
Right. I wouldn't be completely surprised that he was like, oh, this film was set in 1944. So we started using the 44 editing techniques, you know.
Yeah.
It's also all on nitrate film, but anyway.
Right. Oh, no. Exactly. Don't light any pipes near it.
Don't put your pipe near the film.
It is, you know, sometimes it just, the most nominated movie is sometimes the most hailed movie of the year, and sometimes it just happens to fall in certain categories where it gets it. So, like, this is Best Picture and Director. Cillian Murphy for Best Actor. Downey for Best Supporting Actor. Okay. I mean, it depends on who he's up against. It was a much less stacked category than Best Supporting Actress, where Emily Blunt did get nominated. Nolan for Screenplay, Score, Goranson. And then they got the technical awards, Sound, Production Design. So that's the rooms in which the men wear their suits and hats. Cinematography, makeup and hairstyling, the hair under the hat. Costume design, there's your suits
there's
and
your
hats.
There's your hats.
There's your suits.
And film editing.
Right.
because
it's black and white. It's your black and white.
Oh, yeah, boy. It's harder to edit when it's in black and white. You don't know where the colors went.
Well, as we all know, it was already in black and white, so they didn't have to edit any of that coloration away.
Sure. I appreciate the technical level of this podcast. I tell you, it's great.
We're professionals.
Yes. I mean, in terms of dessert, like, I haven't seen all the movies that have been nominated, all the 10 for Best Picture. This was the favorite of the movies I saw last year. It just hit me right. It's long, and yet I think to Nolan's credit, and perhaps to his editor's credit as well, it's a 3-hour movie until that, like, the hearing stuff that I feel like is a little bit long, but, like, it doesn't feel endless and boring, or at least to me. Yeah. I feel like he always gives it a sense of, it's not geography, right? It's time, but, like, everything is connected. Everything moves along at a pace. It keeps cutting sort of between different things. The action moves forward. Having read the book since I saw it the first time, I appreciate some of the shorthand he does to get details of Oppenheimer's life in without dwelling on him, because it's already a long movie. We need to not do that. I think it's technically really well done. I think the screenplay is pretty good, and plays off of the two timelines cleverly. Like, there are a lot of things I really like about it. I haven't seen enough movies to say if it's definitively the best. And of course the Oscars never tells us that either. And it's silly to reward art. I am glad that Barbie got as many nominations as it did, because it was the story of the year in film. And Oppenheimer, yes, the amusing juxtaposition of those two films, you know, it's good because people went and saw movies, and that's good.
Yes.
They're very different movies.
Yeah. I'm kind of glad that we ended that we're at this point, because 2023 was the year that I returned to the cinema, in a way that was pre the before times. So, you know, I feel like I'm in the post times, and I probably go to, I don't know, 30, conservatively 30 films a year.
Well, you've got that $9 movie theater,
right? Exactly.
Yeah,
right. Yeah.
I would also go to that many movies.
I go to the movies all the time, because it's a thing to do. Because most of the time, I'm not even paying $9. I'm paying $7 with reserved seats, with recliners.
Go and rub it in.
I'm
gonna flip my table at you.
Secret movie theater.
Right. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful thing. Shout out to you guys. You know who you are. But
not dropping the name. I know.
You're not even dropping the name. Wow. Gotta keep it a secret.
That's right. That's how it stays a secret. So I really do appreciate all of the films, and I got to see a bunch of films this year, a bunch of films that are on the Best Picture list. I love this film. I thought it was fantastic, but I will say, if I'm allowed to plug what my favorite film of last year I saw it this year because it wasn't in wide release, but American Fiction was phenomenal. If you take away one thing from this podcast, go see Oppenheimer. If you take away two things, go see American Fiction.
Yeah. Also Best Picture nominee. Yeah. Yes. I want to see that. Cord Jefferson.
Yes.
Yeah. Really want to see that. Kathy and Shelley, what were your favorite movies of last year? Why not?
I'm going to be, you know, basic white girl. Barbie stole my heart. Not just the experience. I went opening night with my kid and one of my best friends and her daughter. We all wore pink. Everyone, the energy in that theater was something that I had not seen since, like, Lord of the Rings opening weekend. Like, it just was so much fun, laughing, crying with a group of people. And then the movie itself, I've watched it half a dozen times, and I'm not a big rewatch movie type person. But if I'm like, I want to feel, you know, go team, I'll put it on the side while I'm working. And it just makes me happy, which I love about a movie. I want to be happy when I finish it, which, you know, Oppenheimer, still enjoyed it. Not quite that energy.
Not quite the film that you're putting on to feel happy.
Yes. But
yeah, Barbie is my number one.
I'll just go ahead and say Superman 3. No, I did not. I saw a lot of movies for podcasts. I did not see a lot of new movies this year. I will just mention one that I really want to see and haven't seen yet is May December, because that's like right in my wheel. I love Barbie too. I did not do the whole pink because I guess I'm not a joiner in that way. I like to hide in the back of the theater and go and chuckle and enjoy myself instead of making a delightful spectacle of myself. And more power to you, Kathy, and all your pink colleagues.
Oh yeah, I enjoy making a delightful spectacle of myself because the next night we went to Six the Musical in outfits, and then the next day we went to Taylor Swift. So like it was a 3-day week of
high times.
You know, extravagant outfits. Wild. And it was delightful.
Yeah. So I don't have a proper favorite movie.
All right.
And it is not Superman 3.
I'll check back in 20 years though. Maybe that's there you go. In their old movies. Well, that's I guess I'm gonna next time I go see Oppenheimer, I gotta just put on a suit and wear a hat. That's just how that's going to have to be.
You cannot smoke your pipe in the theater.
No. But you just can have one with bubbles.
It's just bubbles.
Yeah.
All right. We have come to the end. I definitely recommend Oppenheimer. I think that it's very good. And I don't even like all the Christopher Nolan movies, and I thought it was good. So, yes. And everyone is talking about it. So time to do an episode about it, I think. Thank you to my panelists for joining me. Kathy Campbell, thank you.
Thank you so much. We're not convincing, just denying.
Shelley Brisbane, thank you.
Thank you. I intend to wear a hat to the next podcast I'm on. Don't have one on right now, but that is my aspirational hope.
I love it. And Cicero Holmes, thank you. We'll find you at the movies at a secret location.
At a secret location. Near me. I like to wear suits, but the wool makes me itchy.
You need a linen suit.
Yeah. Oh, you'd look sharp in a linen suit, Cicero.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. We'll see you next time.